Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here along with Shad Marquitz. We're your host for this weekend's edition, also your host throughout the week on our website, kereport.com, and podcast, Corlin Economics Report. On this weekend show, we're going to be, as we usually do, jumping around to a few major sectors, but I am going to spend a bit more time chatting about the interest rate environment that we are seeing that really has moved. Probably one of the most aggressive moves we've seen in interest rates when you take percentage-wise moves. We are kicking off this show with Jesse Felder, founder and editor of the Felder Report. Now, Jesse, as I mentioned, interest rates, they have been essentially screaming higher. Even early on this year, just for the first quarter, interest rates, the 10-year opened this year at about 1.5% and is already up over 2.6%. And we only have to go back to the beginning of last year, so 2021, interest rates, the 10-year, right around 1%. And throughout 2020, the 10-year went the whole way down to 0.5%. It's been a massive move higher in rates due to a number of different factors. But I need to ask you, Jesse, simply looking at the chart for rates, can they move much higher from here? Do we need a bit of a digestion phase?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're very close to a short-term top in interest rates, possibly. I've been honestly confused by the bond market recently, and I've kind of given up trying to analyze it because it's been so manipulated by central bank intervention. So, but when I just look at my normal indicators, we're seeing some short-term trend exhaustion signals on interest rates. So obviously, bond sentiment is just in the toilet. Daily DSI shows, very low percentage bulls. And then we're seeing, interest rates are typically very highly correlated with kind of the cyclical sectors within the stock market. And right now, those have been rolling over pretty hard while rates have been going higher. So to me, that's an important divergence. And it could be that rates are just kind of gotten a little bit ahead of themselves. But I would just make one point, which is we're bumping into, this is one of the most important charts that I've been looking at in the last several weeks, is the long term, I'm talking 30-year plus chart of, the 10-year yield and the 30-year yield. They're bumping up against their downtrend lines that literally go back to late 80s, early 90s. And so you have a 30-plus year downtrend that's now being tested. And, that's not just an important signal for whether the downtrend remains intact, but every time we've tested that downtrend, every time interest rates have risen significantly over a number of months, to where they bumped up against that, we've seen rising financial instability. So in 1987, rates popped up to the beginning of this trend, rates popped up. We had the 87 crash. In 2000, we had rates pop up from about 98 to, March of 2000. That obviously was the peak of the dot-com mania. Then, rates bumped up against that downtrend line again in 2006-07. That was the peak of the housing bubble. In 2011 was the next time rates bumped up against that downtrend line. We had this European sovereign debt crisis. And then in 2018, late 2017, early 2018, we had rates rising again fairly rapidly. And we had in early 2018, the Volmageddon episode where those short VIX ETFs blew up, one in particular. And then obviously later in the year, towards the end of 2018, we had a pretty steep stock market sell-off and the famous Powell pivot. Rates now have been rising much more rapidly than any of those previous periods. So I think we need to be on the lookout for some more, another episode of financial instability.
Well, Jesse, you bring up a good point there because a lot of people have noted that the bond market was overdone for decades. I mean, like for 40 years, it was a one-way ticket higher and higher and higher with some brief respites. But a couple of years ago, a lot of people thought, hey, this bond bubble, it can't keep going. And so when the Fed announced that they were going to start reducing their liquidity and their accommodative buying last year, and they were going to start tapering, a lot of people thought, well, who's going to buy those bonds? I think we've even asked you that question at the time, you know, maybe a year ago or 6 months ago, who is going to buy these bonds? And what we're seeing is, as the Fed has pulled their liquidity out of the marketplace, there isn't as many people buying these bonds, and therefore rates have gone higher. So some of this was telegraphed a year or two ago, that we knew rates couldn't have gotten lower than 0.4%. And now that we see rates screaming higher, isn't that just indicative of them pulling away the punch bowl and liquidity drying up? And we're seeing that, you know, across the board, not just in bonds, but also in the stock markets. There's a liquidity, you know, vacuum, and this is the result of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Fed has been, you know, depressing or suppressing interest rates, nominal interest rates, for, you know, well over a decade now, really since they embarked on, you know, QE back in 2008, 2009. And what we saw during the pandemic was by far the biggest intervention in the bond market that we've seen in generations, if not of all time. And so, yeah, now that they've said we're not going to be in the market buying, and the government is still issuing tons of debt to meet pretty massive still, you know, fiscal deficits. Yeah, there's a supply-demand mismatch. And it's actually just reset. You know, rates are probably back to where, you know, they should have been a couple of years ago. But I do think, you know, that's a really important question to ask. If the Fed is not going to be in the market, who's going to buy these bonds? And that's a question. I think if rates do continuing to power higher, you know, we will hear discussion of yield curve control again. You know, the Bank of Japan has been stepping into the markets again to pin longer term yields. And look at what the yen's done in response. It's, you know, it went into free fall. So I think that's something that we could look to, you know, in the future. But I think right now, markets are not pricing in rapidly rising recession risk. Certainly the bond market is not quite. I mean, with rates rising right now, we've seen the yield curve invert. I do think that's an effective recession signal. But with rates rising in the last few days, I think that's kind of goes against this idea that we're seeing rapidly rising recession probability.
So, Jesse, one other thing that everyone's looking at when it comes to yields is the yield curve. And the yield curve did just slightly invert earlier this week. It was, or at least the 2 and the 10-year, it dipped into slightly negative territory. And a lot of people point to an inversion of the yield curve, saying that about 6 to 18 months off, we usually do get a recession. The last time the yield curve just briefly inverted was back in 2019. And hey, strangely enough, we had the COVID pandemic shortly after. That one came a bit quicker in terms of that recession. But truly, when the yield curve has gone negative, back in 2006, 2007, we all know what happened in 2008 with the big recession. And then going back to about the year 2000, what do you need to see in terms of a yield curve inversion, in terms of time frame, in terms of depth of the inversion, that gives you the confidence even more so to say that this recession is coming and it'll be coming in 6 to 18 months?
Well, there's a number of indicators that I look at that are all, I mean, it's not just the yield curve, but I think the yield curve is an important one to just think about, right? And why is the yield curve such a good predictor of recession? I think there's two reasons. One is, why would essentially 2-year rates be the same as 10-year rates? So how is that possible in a market where the Fed has stepped away, right? The Fed has stepped away and is not intervening in the bond market anymore. So I think we can trust the signals today that we're getting, whereas we possibly couldn't have trusted them over the past, you know, 2 years, because they were intervening so significantly. But the only reason you get 10-year and 2-year yields at essentially the same rate, or 10-year lower than 2, is investors are really wanting to lock in an interest rate for as long as they possibly can. 10-year, 30-year bonds, they're willing to, and why would they be willing to or wanting to lock those in as long as they can? Well, they anticipate short-term rates are going to come back down again, right? And they don't want to buy a 2-year treasury and then have it mature in 2 years and say, oh, you know what, I can't reinvest these proceeds at 2.5% anymore. You know, I can only reinvest it at 0.5%. So what would make those 2-year yields come down? Well, that would be recession, you know, is really the only thing that would bring two-year rates back down from 2.5% of where they are today. So that's investors essentially telling you that they believe recession is likely, and that will prevent them from being able to reinvest short-term debt at the higher yields they're seeing today. The other side of that is, how do banks make money? Banks make money lending long and borrowing short. And so if you think about the credit cycle, right, when there's a good spread between short-term and long-term rates, that's basically a good potential for profit for banks. And so they're going to be very eager to go borrow short and lend long because it's very profitable for them to do so. When the yield curve inverts or at least just flattens, they have no incentive to go lend, right? I'm 2-year and 10-year money is the same. My spread is gone, so I'm going to tighten monetary or tighten credit conditions, and we're not going to be lending as much. And so the credit cycle goes along with that. So I think it's important to think about, this is not just a mechanical signal of recession. This is investors telling you recession is probably coming. The market's telling you recession is probably coming. You know, the credit cycle telling you that we've reached the end of this credit cycle, and that we're probably going into a period of tightening credit, goes right along with what the Fed is doing. So, I think that's an important thing to consider, that it's not just, hey, this mechanical thing, this indicator telling recession is coming. No, there's structural reasons as to why this indicator matters.
Well, Jesse, another thing that people point to as a indicator for a potential slowing down of growth and recession is higher energy prices. In fact, the energy price is doubling year over year. I mean, some could argue that we saw energy prices go negative just 2 years ago, and then they were kind of hovering in the 20 to 30 range. We're now over $100 a barrel in oil. So is that another indicator you're looking at, is what's happening in the energy market as a tax on everything from business to consumer?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, from where I sit, the yield curve is just one of many indicators that are pointing to a high risk of recession over the next 12 to 18 months. Oil prices is one. In fact, when you look at together, actually, one of the indicators I use is just the average 12-month rise in the 10-year yield, in the oil price, and in the dollar. Because when those things are rising, it creates a headwind to the economy and a headwind to corporate profits. When those things are falling together, it's the reverse. It's a nice tailwind to profits in the economy. Well, for the last 2 years, and this operates with about a 2-year lead, for the last 2 years, we've obviously been seeing, since, you know, go back to the March 2020 lows, we had oil prices go negative, interest rates, I think the 10-year went down to about 50 basis points, and the dollar sold off pretty hard kind of in the wake of all those Fed stimulus measures. Since then, we've seen the dollar rise very strongly over the last year. Oil prices are up a ton, and interest rates have, gone from 50 basis points to 250 basis points on the 10-year. So all those things create a huge headwind to the economy and basically forecast a pretty steep earnings recession sometime over the next several quarters. But specifically to the oil price, I can't remember which firm it was. It was a brokerage firm put out a research piece recently showing that every time the oil price rises, the real price rises, that's oil price after inflation, more than 50% year over year, we've had a recession. And we've seen, obviously, oil prices rise much more than 50% after inflation. So yeah, so you have this confluence of factors. It's not just the bond market telling us, it's the dollar, it's oil prices. All these things are kind of conspiring now to point towards rising recessionary risks.
Jesse, how much of a factor did that whole reopen trade play in this general slowdown in GDP, in the increase in energy prices? There was this general boost, this general sugar high when the U.S. economy especially started to reopen. Numbers got better, especially economic numbers, and people were out there spending. Largely, I believe people have run out of that more free money that they got. And from what I've seen, credit card debt has started to rise again. What's the impact, carryover effect from that reopen trade that I think is largely behind us now?
Well, I absolutely agree with you. I think essentially what we've discovered with the inflation numbers and the economic numbers and all this stuff is that we way overstimulated, right? Printing $5, $6 trillion and putting it directly in the hands of consumers has created a huge surge in demand, which has led to a huge surge in inflation. And now that those things are being withdrawn, fiscal and monetary stimulus, now we're headed for a major hangover. And I would say you can just look to the stock market itself. And one of my favorite speeches Stan Druckenmiller gave was back in middle of 2019 when he said, the best economist he's ever seen is the inside of the stock market, not the stock market itself, but the inside. So the relative performance of cyclical sectors within the stock market, things like small caps, and they have a very high correlation to economic growth. You just look at the relative performance of small cap to large cap, and it's very highly correlated. It leads manufacturing activity by a number of months. And so when small caps are leading to the upside, it's a really good sign for the economy, and vice versa. We've seen small caps, lead to the downside stronger than any, even worse than they did in the COVID crash. So literally since, you have to go back to, 20 plus years to just before the dot-com bubble burst to see small cap relative performance any weaker than it has been recently. So that to me is a very strong sign. And then you have stocks like retail, home builders, transports. Most recently, the truckers have been absolutely annihilated in the last week or so. All this to me is the stock, the inside of the stock market telling you things are not as great as economists and their forecasts would suggest right now.
Well, Jesse, in light of this, where we're seeing so many sectors pulling back, we saw a lot of newly minted investors over the last 2 years jump into the markets, think they could only go one way, and they really got aggressive with a lot of the speculative side of things, from NFTs and cryptos to the growth and tech stocks. I just saw an article yesterday highlighting how the ARK Innovation Fund was one of the worst performing funds, not just at the fourth quarter, but also in the first quarter of this year. So we've seen a big shift from growth and that speculative fervor over into value. Will value continue to get the bid? Are people going to stay defensive? And where would you recommend investors go to kind of ride out the coming storm? If we're going to be facing a recession in a year, Will there be one more sugar high before that, or where are you going to park money in this kind of a macro backdrop?
Yeah, I think it's more important to understand what you want to avoid right now. I am still very bullish on commodities. I think we are in a secular bull market for commodities. Oil prices, the real oil price is still well below its highs from 10, 15 years ago. So, I do think those things can continue to move higher, but I'm glad you asked about the implications for the stock market, because it brings me to one other indicator that I've written extensively about, and that's just the insider sell to buy ratio. In March of 2020, we saw insider buying step up in a huge way. That was a very good predictor for the rally that we've seen. Najat Sehun, who's a University of Michigan business school professor, has quantified a lot of these things, and he shows when the insider sell to buy ratio gets really low, meaning there's a lot of buying relative to selling, it's very bullish for the stock market 12 to 24 months later, but it's also very bullish for the economy. It's not just a vote of confidence for the stock prices and valuations. It's a vote of confidence for the fundamentals, the earnings, and the direction of the economy. What we saw at the end of last year in November, December, was the sell to buy ratio went from under 10 in March of 2020 to well over 30 by the end of last year. And that's the highest we've seen in all the data that I have going back over a decade. So to me, that's a very clear sign, with insider selling far surpassing insider buying last year, that the next 12 to 24 months in the stock market is going to be rocky. And the economy, that's insiders telling you that fundamentals, right, earnings growth, these types of things are not going to be great over the next 12 to 24 months. And so I think you want to avoid, stocks generally. I think that the stocks that have benefited most from all of these dynamics, low inflation, a very activist Fed, I think you have to point to the biggest stocks in the NASDAQ. And when I look at these, the big five, I call them Manta, because you got Microsoft, Amazon, Nvidia, Tesla, and Apple, right? That's the big five right now in the NASDAQ. Put them all together, take their market cap, divide it by their total aggregate free cash flow, minus back out stock-based compensation. They're trading at 70 times cash flow right now. That's absolutely insane to me, that you're heading towards an earnings recession, probably, and probably an economic recession. And in the midst of this, the Fed is tightening monetary policy. They're more They've never been possibly further behind the curve than they are today, so they have to play catch up. You have Bill Dudley, former New York Fed chair, today saying, if stocks don't go down, the Fed has to force them down. And in the midst of all this, you have the top five biggest stocks in the NASDAQ and the S&P 500 trading at 70 times free cash flow. To me, that's what you want to avoid. You really need to stay away from these things that have gotten so obscenely overvalued.
All right, Jesse, we're going to wrap it up here. But look, those high-flying tech stocks, now there's even been maybe a slight change or at least an addition to that list. They carried the markets for a long period of time. And if sentiment does change that much on those stocks, then, well, you would have to think that markets would pull back. And where would that money rotate into? Who knows? Tough to say right now. But I do not disagree with you that markets are on way more shaky footing. And it's a number of factors, all considering what the U.S. and the world just went through in the last 2+ years. Jesse, thank you as always for your time, buddy. We'll chat again in a few weeks. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend. And yeah, looking forward to chatting with you again, buddy.
Thanks, gents. Always good talking to you guys.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed those first two segments with Jesse Felder. Boy, oh boy, there was a lot of talk about recession and trying to make sense of some of the data we're seeing, especially in terms of market moves. We're going to carry that conversation over a little bit now as we are chatting with Axel Merk, President and Chief Investment Officer at Merk Investments. Now, as I mentioned, recession was the focus of the last segment, and it ties in nicely to an email that was sent out to the subscribers of Merk Research. It was the business cycle chart book where Axel and his team were outlining a number of different data points, a lot within the U.S., but also some outside the U.S., looking at Europe and Asia. Now, Axel, when it comes to U.S. economic data, what are some of the key focuses that you have? What do you think is some of the more important information that we are going to be getting throughout this year to help investors gauge if we really are going down this road of a devastating recession?
Yes, great to be with you. And I guess that the first thing we should say, why do we care about the economy? And aside from us potentially losing a job, it is that the stock market risk assets tend to do much better during economic expansions, during recessions. That said, there have been recessions, several where the downturn hasn't been so severe. So not everything is an 08 recession or a deep stock market collapse or 2000. But that's why we look at it. And in fact, one of the things your previous guests have talked about, the inversion of the yield curve a few months ago, nobody had heard of it, I suppose, other than the economists. But it's we look at that, but you might even want to be more concerned about when things become more normal again, because that is when the Fed starts to panic and starts lowering interest rates. And so the initial inversion when the short-term rates are higher than the long-term rates is just the canary in the coal mine, so to speak. What you want to be really concerned about is when then the Fed actually takes the action the other way around and starts easing, because that means they are, again, then behind the curve. Right. First, they say, oh, there's no problem. And then they said, oops, there's a problem. They slam on the brakes and then they go back again. And indeed, currently, the market is pricing in that the Fed will peak out sometime in the probably the summer next year. Who knows whether that's going to be the case or not. But if you listen at the most recent Fed minutes, suddenly they're all over them. Saying, oh, 50 basis points, and yes, we have to shrink the balance sheet dramatically. And by the way, we don't like inflation after all. And so it's when this catching up happens, as we have right now, that you'll have to start thinking in more in earnest of, well, maybe the brakes are going to be slammed now after all, and maybe we should be looking at the next thing already. So the Fed is so far behind the curve that it may be ahead of the curve, thinking of the next cycle already.
That is interesting, Axel, because the markets are forward-looking, but it's interesting. We just got the first rate hike in, and they're supposed to have a series of rate hikes, but most of the discussions we've been having is, at what point do they stop and reverse course? And there's already people betting on when the Fed will start cutting rates again. So that is very forward-looking, but to your point about the recent Fed minutes, they are getting more aggressive. They are going to start considering these 50 basis point hikes, but they're still really far behind the curve, and we're still in a very negative real rate environment. So do you think that the market will really react the way it has in the past and have a big tantrum, kind of like a taper tantrum? Or is most of this already priced into where the markets are, having had a rough first quarter to kick off 2022?
Yes. Next question. So it's I mean, who knows, right? Interest rates, yield, real interest rates, if you look at 10-year real yields, which is the inflation-protected securities, for example, the yield on those has moved up to about, as we're talking anyway, which is a few days before you broadcast this, at about minus 27 basis points. And it was as low as minus 1%, the real yields, just a few weeks ago. So rates have gone up dramatically in some ways, but they're still negative, right? So we still have financial repression. And ultimately, yes, you can argue everything is priced in, but at the same time, we see things like mortgage rates move up dramatically. And one, just anecdotally, right, some of these mortgage brokers have had several rounds of layoffs. Layoffs at mortgage brokers is a leading indicator to the housing market. And ultimately, the Federal Reserve cannot afford for housing prices to go down. Now, they don't want them to go up in a straight line, but that fine-tuning is really the real problem with inflation is that the fine-tuning is all the more difficult, right? I have no doubt that the Federal Reserve doesn't like inflation, but what are they going to do about it? They drag their heels forever, and now they suddenly want to slam on the brakes. And I've said before, the biggest problem with higher inflation is that policy and with that markets will be more volatile, because you're going to have these knee-jerk reactions. And that is ultimately not good for assets in the markets. It's not good for employment. It's not good for confidence in the Fed to the extent there's confidence left. And then, by the way, on that note, we joke about there's no confidence in the Fed. If you look at what's priced in long-term in the market, those things are reasonably stable. And that means the market as a whole has confidence in the Fed. So you or I may not think the Fed is going to do the right thing tomorrow, but the market hasn't lost confidence yet.
That is true. And the Fed still does carry a very heavy hand for these markets. But Axel, as much as we look at economic data, it has changed so drastically prior to the COVID crash. 2020 was a very noteworthy year because we did have that immediate crash in an environment where we were stuck in slow growth, low inflation for 5-10 years practically. And then COVID, with the maybe very quick recession or at least market crash that we had, almost completely changed all this data starting last year when we had these rollover comparatives that, quite frankly, the world was shut down and then the world was opening up. How do you balance out this, what seems like different environment that we have now post-COVID because of the major swings in data that we're seeing?
Well, one of the things I'd like to add to that, for the longest period, everything was dollar-centric. The dollar would go up or down versus other currencies. Well, in recent weeks, or especially since the escalation in Ukraine, currencies are all over the place. Some currencies up versus the dollar, some are down. And part of that is because there's a crisis in Europe that affects Europe more. Part of it is because we suddenly have a divergence in what central banks are doing. Right? The Australia just said a few days ago that they're not going to be patient anymore. And similarly, so some countries are digging in and saying, oh, no, we don't need to do anything, whereas other countries are storming ahead. And from an investor's point of view, in many ways, that's healthy because you have a greater dispersion of risk. You can allocate capital based on your analysis rather than just following where the central banks are going to steer their bazooka towards. And so in the medium term, that's healthy. Now, of course, it comes from a background where all asset prices are distorted. And so, yes, that means we'll have some hiccups in the markets. And we've seen, of course, some dislocations. I'm sure you've talked about the copper snafu that has happened, where the London Metal Exchange just canceled a bunch of trades. that sort of stuff is symptomatic when central banks are taking a step back and suddenly you have to find real market prices. And I mean, Warren Buffett says you find out who swims naked when the tide comes back out. And the quote unquote good news is we haven't seen a blow up, so to speak, that's affecting quote unquote everybody. But you have these mini crises around, and as long as they're mini crises, it's a healthy process towards, I don't want to use the term normalization because I don't think what's coming up is normal, but it's healthy that the market is able to express itself again.
Yeah, that's a good point, Axel. I don't know that we're going to have anything that's resulting in normal, maybe a new normal, but it is nice to see different central banks around the world taking different policies, a little variety out there. But you brought up what happened in the nickel space with the limit up and then the LME reversing those contracts. We really have seen across the board in the commodity complex, you know, the oil and nat gas space racing higher. We've seen the base metals, whether it's zinc, lead, aluminum, iron. We've seen gold have a pretty good run. Silver, not as much, but we've seen the agricultural products, fertilizers, really the whole commodity sector. Many people are pointing to this as just the supply chain issues. Some have pointed to the Ukraine issue, but there's a lot of people that have been mentioning this was on the horizon for a while due to inflation, and we've seen inflation numbers tick up. How much of this recent commodity rise do you think is sticky because of the price actions as a result of inflation and increasing the money supply? And how much of it do you think is more transitory?
Well, volatility, I guess, is the name of the game. And first of all, I'd discourage anybody from trading any of these things. You really got to know what you're doing if you touch these commodities, especially, I mean, obviously the ones with that you'd use derivatives to trade them in. Clearly, Ukraine being offline, so to speak, affects agricultural commodities. Fertilizers affected with Russia being sanctioned and all that, right? And so we have supply chain issues, lots of stuff happening on the oil side. Part of it is the economy opening up. So all these factors are contributing factors. Some of it will be cyclical, right? And commodity prices are cyclical in the long run. I am quite concerned about stagflation. Those headlines keep popping up more in Europe than in the US at this stage. But yeah, if the Fed slams on the brakes and we have continued to have high commodity prices, to me, that has some resemblance of the 1970s, right? People were laughing about that just a few months ago. And now people are saying, well, maybe there's something to it. Ultimately, there's the cure to high prices, maybe high prices, right? When fuel prices are high enough, we'll drive less. But fear not, right? In California, I don't know whether they've passed it, but they want to send checks to people to afford the gasoline. Yeah, send more money so that they can consume more. Now, you need to have the high prices, obviously, to bring supply and demand back into balance. And policymakers will say these particular commodities are crucial and therefore will interfere with the market. And so I think we'll see a lot more disruption in these spaces as governments think that they know better than the market as to how these commodities should be allocated.
What are you worried about in terms of government stepping in? Because sometimes we do hear the fact that, oh, if governments come in and say, make this a critical metal or try to help out the consumer, then it can play havoc in these different commodities. What do you think is most at risk? What could governments even do here, Axel?
Let me first maybe tell you the one that I think is less at risk than many in your audience believe, and which is gold. Many people believe the government is going to go out and confiscate your gold. A lot of the folks that I know in government don't understand gold and it's not on the horizon, right? They think about oil, they think about whatever the critical materials are to build a battery-driven economy, that sort of thing, right? And so there will be a lot of talk about many of these things, and we've seen the initiative that, oh, businesses must invest in fracking. Well, at the same time, they don't ease the regulations. So a lot of that is noise because politicians say these things without really understanding them, and then everybody's going to cover it. And if you look a little bit deeper, not much is really changing, right? And it depends on the commodity. Agricultural commodities, you can ramp up quicker. Fracking, by the way, Europe could invest in fracking. You can generate gas in Europe, and by the way, it's not worse for the environment. It's probably better for the environment if you frack it in Germany than if you were to do it in somewhere in Russia. But I think we'll be very confused with all the headlines coming out. And yes, once in a while, some states, maybe even the federal government, is going to impose some rule. that's going to be very disruptive. And it's to appease the base, but it's anything they'll do in any of these spaces is probably going to be not particularly helpful. But what I'm most concerned about, I'm not really too concerned about it. I think I've been hardened by so many years of capital misallocation that if there were some new price controls or other things come out, I don't think I'll be shocked.
Well, actually, you brought up gold there and said you don't think the government is going to seize it. So that's good news for anybody holding physical. But you also had talked about currencies earlier in the discussion. And when we're looking at the dollar or we're looking at the dollar index, it's really some fiat currencies in relation to each other that are all getting eroded over time due to inflation. And if you look at gold priced in those currencies, it's gone up on almost any currency on the planet, near all-time highs or at all-time highs. Do you think that's sustainable? And do you think we'll continue to see that trend in gold relative to global currencies? Or do you think we're at an inflection point here where it's just gotten a little bit ahead of itself due to the last couple of years of kind of financial chaos in the markets?
Sure. How many hours do I have to answer that question? So first of all, I think the recent inflationary trend and what I foresee is going to create volatility in the price of gold. Because when the market thinks that the Fed is really earnest in getting rid of inflation, yes, there can be a headwind to the price of gold. But we also discussed that this is going to crash the economy and then they have to revert. And so depending on the mood of the day, that's going to affect the price of gold. And net, I do believe the price of gold is going to be higher at the end of the day. When it comes to other currencies, indicated earlier, Europe, of course, is particularly affected by what's happening in Ukraine. Their energy use as percent of GDP has skyrocketed, in part because they're so dependent on Russian gas, and there's a lot of distortions there. Yes, over time, all these fiat currencies may well lose versus the price of gold. But at the same time, as countries like the commodity producing ones in particular are reflating their economy more successfully and the commodities are on high demand, and these central banks are getting rid of their COVID policies, I do think that there are some opportunities there for quite significant outperformance versus the dollar. I'm still in the camp, and I put my neck out in the spring of 2019, that we've kind of had a secular turning point. The dollar had been increasing for several years, that it would, in this economic cycle, go down. The jury is still out whether that will happen, because obviously in part because of the invasion of Ukraine and the dollar index at least being very euro heavy, we've kind of been more and more flattish on that. But we are still overall in a theme where I think that reflation is going to take place when Asia opens up and whatnot. And all of that is a bit of a dollar short. So it really depends on the Fed is going to do, and this can play out in many different ways.
Since we're talking about the Fed, we did have Fed minutes released on Wednesday. Axel, do you see anything new in these Fed minutes outside of, again, the expectations of maybe some more rate hikes, maybe some even 50 basis point rate hikes into next year?
Well, what's new is that apparently the current Fed is announcing the minutes for policy announcements. They used to be massaged minutes that go through all the desks and everybody is saying, oh, let's iron this out a little bit, not surprise anybody. But this time around, they announced that they'll probably want to wind down the balance sheet by about $95 billion a month. And on top of that, that quote-unquote many on the FOMC wanted a 50 basis point rate hike. You and I listened to Powell speak, but I don't think that there was any talk about many on the FOMC wanting a 50 basis point rate hike. They were all quiet, right? And it seems like even the doves wanted that. So maybe they changed their mind afterwards and now put it in the minutes. But these minutes are becoming more important because Powell doesn't want to say anything during the press conference to not upset the markets. And then afterwards, they let out all these pieces of information that eventually accumulate in the minutes. So it's a new process. And I don't know, I guess it's refreshing that we get some new information, but it's all a little, seems a bit haphazard and immature is how they release that information. And ultimately, that again creates volatility in the market.
Yeah, and there's always the parsing of the Fed minutes and every word and whether the algorithms are keyed off those words. And people often see knee-jerk reaction in the markets right after these minutes come out. But I'd like to focus it back on one other market mover besides the central banks, and that's the consumer. Axel, a lot of consumers are more strapped now than they have been, especially in the U.S., but I think globally, their inflation in food cost, inflation in fuel cost, hits them and everything they buy and everything they ship. And so we're seeing reports out that consumer discretionary income is going down. People are pulling off their savings. They're even dipping and using credit cards. Do you think we're going to see further stagflationary forces, as you mentioned earlier, just a slowing of growth because the consumer is tapped out at this point in the cycle?
Yeah, so you, first reference to kind of global consumer, I do think there will be famine in the world after many of the agricultural exports are not happening or have skyrocketed in price. That usually doesn't make for happy families. That means that political stability in many other parts of the world is probably going to be on the decline in the months and years to come. So that's just a global context. And then domestically, you mentioned they might even use credit cards. Well, that used to be the default, right? Then during COVID, the government wrote all these checks and people had money to buy meme stocks and whatnot. Now, of course, the more vulnerable folks that actually have a long commute, and that happens in many communities because they can't afford to live where they work. You and I, we can work from home, right? We don't like the higher gas prices, but it's not the end of the world for us. And so, yes, that will, on the one hand, get people upset, and that will probably be shown when it comes to voting this November. And yes, they have started some families have made choices, right? Food on the table or fuel for the truck, right? So that you can drive to work. That said, defaults and so forth are still very, very low, right? So the strain that you see in the numbers that we in the indices get published are still rather benign. And so, those are the ones that the Fed is looking at, which also means that the Fed is not going to be deterred from the anecdotal evidence that we see so far. They want to see their numbers look bad. And when they look bad, things are going to be really bad for the consumer. And yes, the word stagflation comes up again. I think that word will come up more in months to come as the economy is slowing down.
It all makes a roundabout turn back to stagflation right now, because there are a lot of people starting to talk more about stagflation. And this time, I believe, with a lot more data behind them as well, including what the markets are doing. So, Axel, it's always great chatting with you. Thank you very much for your time. If anyone wants to follow along with Axel and what Merck Investments is doing, you can follow Axel on Twitter, which I will post his handle in the weekend show posting, as well as a link to the Merck Investments website. Axel, thank you again for your time. Everybody, thank you for tuning in on this weekend show. I hope you all have a great rest of your weekend, and I hope this weekend show wasn't too depressing in the sense that, yes, there are some recession fears out there, but we'll see how everything is managed this year, especially from central banks, because, well, we just don't know what's going to happen, and volatility is clearly here to stay for 2022. Everyone, have a great rest of your weekend. Axel, thank you again for your time.
Take care.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.